Casting the truth, the puppet media dare not report. Long live liberty and death to the new world order. Prepare yourself. This is the alternative media.
Hey gang, I'm on the scene. Welcome to National Bugle Radio. I am your host, Dr. Patrick Slattery. Now we have a very interesting show lined up for you today. I had a guest that I was expecting, but last minute technical difficulties have led to the postponement of that interview until next week. And so, it gave me an idea. There's something I've been meaning to do for a long time. About 6 years ago or so, when Elena Kagan was appointed to the Supreme Court, I wrote an article about her, and I've wanted to turn that into a podcast for a while, and I'm going to do something a little bit new, something I haven't tried before. I'm going to interview myself. And so today, I'm going to interview Robot Patrick Slattery. Robot Patrick Slattery, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Patrick. I am a really big fan, you know.
Okay, so Elena Kagan was appointed to the Supreme Court by Barack Obama back in 2010. And she's a Jewish lesbian. We're pretty sure she's a lesbian. That's not official. She's not officially out, but if you walk like a lesbian and you talk like a lesbian, then pretty sure you're a duck.
That's right, Patrick.
So why don't you tell us why Elena Kagan's story is important? Why is she a good example to raise when we think about how Jews have become so influential in American politics? And by the way, because some of our listeners might have some qualms about, you know, you being a robot and everything.
I am a robot. Robots would never infiltrate your society masquerading as one of your own and then take over, enslaving you. That's what Jews do. What do you think we are? Jews? You can trust us, Goyim.
Well, that's good to know. Okay, so tell us about Elena Kagan.
The reaction to the appointment of Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court in 2010 was a case study in how taboos are maintained in our society regarding the 600-pound gorilla of Jewish power. It is not just that little was said about the fact that she would be the third Jewish justice on the 9-member court in a country barely 2% Jewish, leaving the majority Protestant country without a Protestant on the High Court. It is not just that she was generally lacking in qualifications for the appointment and for pretty much every other job she has ever gotten. What was really interesting was how the Jewish media diverted attention from the phenomenon of Jewish power and privilege by raising the specter of white privilege. And when I say specter, I really mean ghost, because white privilege for all intents and purposes is dead and gone, as the Elena Kagan nomination controversy illustrates.
Well, frankly, I don't know how much white privilege there ever was in the first place. But anyway, back to the story. So, 2010, Justice John Paul Stevens retires, and President Obama needs to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court. Was the appointment of Elena Kagan, somebody with so little experience and such thin credentials, was it a surprise to anyone?
Okay. When Obama was set to make his second nomination for the Supreme Court, Kagan's selection was neither a surprise nor ever seriously in doubt. She had already been on the short list of candidates to fill the first vacancy, which eventually went to Sonia Sotomayor. There were some voices raised, mostly on the right, regarding Kagan's complete lack of judicial experience and her relative lack of courtroom experience. However, the truly interesting objections were raised by observers on the left regarding the lack of diversity in her recruitment of professors while she was the dean of Harvard Law School. The liberal online magazine Salon published an article by four law professors from less prestigious schools noting that all but one of the 32 tenure-track professors hired while Kagan was dean were white. These professors, two of whom were black, one South Asian, and one with a half-Hispanic hyphenated surname, Luis Fuentes Roer, make seven references to whites in their 1,679-word piece, yet never once use the word Jew.
So there was some controversy over this lack of diversity, having so many white people appointed to these faculty positions. Where did you hear about this? And was anybody talking about the fact that they were Jews? And frankly, how do you know they were Jews? I mean, you can tell they're white, but how do you know who is Jewish? I mean, after all, Jews look white to me.
Okay. I first heard about this controversy on Democracy Now, during a discussion between Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig and progressive blogger Glenn Greenwald. I immediately searched for a list of the professors to get an idea of the ethnic background. My internet search turned up a massive discussion of the race of the professors, but not a list of names or any other indication as to their ethnic background. It was noted on some sites that the faculty at leading schools like Harvard were largely Jewish, and there was a list of all current law professors at Harvard, but nobody had a list of the 32 professors that Kagan hired. So, using the Internet Archive service called the Wayback Machine, I found a list of Harvard Law School's tenured or tenure-track professors shortly before Kagan's appointment and another shortly after her departure.
And then you compared the two lists, and by subtraction, you were able to see who was new on the second list, and those must have been the people that Elena Kagan hired. That's really smart, I gotta hand it to you. Okay, so how many Jews did you find?
Naturally, it came as no surprise to find that easily half of the list had Jewish-sounding surnames. Of course, surnames are not rock-solid indicators of someone's ethnicity, so I went down a list one by one to see if I could find any reliable sources demonstrating that a professor either was or was not Jewish. Working alphabetically, at first it seemed it would be easy as two of the first professors whose backgrounds I checked were not just Jewish but Israeli. But it then started becoming tedious, as many of the younger recent hires have little biographical data on the internet. My preliminary results thereby were as follows. Confirmed Jews, 8. Probable Jews, 7. Married to a Jew, 2. Probable non-Jew, 5. Confirmed non-Jew, 3. Uncertain, 7.
Okay, Mr. Robot. I'm going to stop you there for a second because in the intervening years, I have been able to track down some of these other people to see whether or not they're Jewish. And so here's the actual list as of right now. We have 12 out of the 32, 12 confirmed Jews, 4 probable Jews. And when I say probable, it's pretty probable. We'll get into the details in a little bit, but that's 16, fully one half, that are probably Jewish. At least two more, are married to Jews. And then there's 6 that I'm still not sure about. There are 5 who are probably not Jewish and 3 who are certainly not Jewish.
That's a lot of Jews. So who are these Jews? The 8 confirmed Jews are Noah Feldman, Yochai Benkler, Gabriella Bloom, Robert H. Sidkoff, Cass R. Sunstein, Mark Tushnet, Jesse M. Fried, and Jed Schuderman. Benkler and Bloom are Israelis.
And I can add to that Glenn Cohen, William Rubenstein, Michael Clareman, and Daryl Levinson. I have, in the intervening years, confirmed that they are Jews, along with Noah Feldman, Yochai Benkler, Gabriella Bloom, Robert H. Sitkoff, Cass R. Sunstein, Mark Tushnet, Jesse Fried, and Jed Sugarman. And that's a lot of Jews. And regarding Cass Sunstein, I want to mention that he is the husband of the very unfortunate-looking Samantha Power, who was President Obama's UN ambassador, and very likely would have been perhaps a national security advisor for a President Hillary Clinton. We really dodged a bullet on that one. But Samantha Power, who was just so incredibly Zionist in her representations at the United Nations. So this just goes to show you the incredibly Jewish milieu that exists at Harvard Law School and Harvard in general.
That's right, Patrick. The seven probable Jews are I. Glenn Cohen, Jody Freeman, John C. P. Goldberg, William Rubinstein, Michael Klarman, Daryl Levinson, and Benjamin Sachs. In the cases of Klarman and Levinson, there were probable indications in addition to their surnames.
Well, that's right. And of course, in the intervening years, as I've mentioned, I have confirmed that both Klarman and Levinson are Jewish, along with Rubinstein, who I wasn't sure of before, but now I am sure of. Now tell us about the two, at least two, individuals on this list who are married to Jews.
The two professors married to Jews were Ann Alstott and Jeannie Suk.
That's Jeannie Suk. Suk, it's a Korean last name.
Alstott was married in a synagogue and her mother's maiden name was Kincaid, so she also should be considered a probable Jew.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right there because I think it's important to emphasize to our listeners the high standards that we use when we say these people are Jewish. You just mentioned the case of Ann Alstott. Alstott doesn't sound Jewish, but you noted her mother is Kincaid. Kincaid's a Jewish name. She's married to a Jew, and she got married in a synagogue. Yet, on our list, we don't have her even as a probable Jew. Maybe we should. And then, of course, the people we have is probably being Jewish. You're talking about Benjamin Sachs. Really sounds pretty Jewish. I just don't have proof of it. John Goldberg, Jody Freeman, Benjamin Rowan. So these are pretty high standards. If you include those five individuals, including Alstott, along with the 12 that we've already named, that would be an outright majority of the 32 professors that Elena Kagan hired, who in fact were Jewish. Please continue, Mr. Robot.
Okay. Jeannie Suk is Korean, the lone non-white, and is married to Noah Feldman.
Yeah, she's Korean, and it's pronounced Jeannie Suk.
Yeah, sure. There was quite a lot on the internet regarding this marriage, as Feldman is Orthodox and was lambasted by other Orthodox Jews for having married outside his group. He in turn complained that he and his wife were photoshopped out of a picture of his Orthodox high school reunion. It is unclear whether Suk has converted to Judaism.
Suk. Jeannie Suk.
Whatever. I could not make a determination regarding seven others. D. James Greiner, Adrienne Lanny, Benjamin Royne, Matthew Stevenson, George G. Triantis, Rachel Brewster, and Gerald L. Newman. Even so, we have at least 16 on the Jewish or probably Jewish list, plus Suk. That means that non-Jewish whites could account for less than half of the appointments made by Kagan. However, non-Jewish whites make up 70% of the population of the United States. So where is the white privilege? Clearly, non-Jewish whites were underrepresented among Kagan's appointments, just as they are underrepresented at Kagan's new workplace, the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, Jews, who make up only 2% of the U.S. population, get half of the appointments. In other words, their share of Kagan's hirings was 25 times their share of the U.S. population. But all we heard in the media was that all but one of her appointments was white. This is a good illustration that for many of the most important jobs, fears of whites being passed over in favor of blacks benefiting from affirmative action are simply misplaced. It is clearly Jewish privilege that is crowding whites out of these jobs. It may well be that the biggest harm to whites caused by affirmative action is to distract whites with a red herring.
Well, certainly that's the case if we're talking about the Supreme Court or Harvard Law School faculty appointments. But later on in the program, we're going to be talking about admissions to undergraduate degree programs at Harvard and other elite schools. And here we will find, in addition to the considerable Jewish pressure, we're going to find a lot of pressure on whites from affirmative action in favor of blacks and Hispanics. Please continue.
Okay. In case you are wondering why it is that the media mislabels Jewish privilege as white privilege, it is because the media itself, of course, is to a large extent run by Jews and is itself a bastion of Jewish privilege. Rick Sanchez's fall from grace the moment he alluded to this truth is just the most recent confirmation. The Jewish gatekeepers of the media keep this topic absolutely taboo.
You mentioned Rick Sanchez, and that by now was maybe 5 years ago. For our listeners who don't recall, Rick Sanchez was one of CNN's leading anchormen. But Jon Stewart, the former host of The Daily Show, who's a very obvious and in many ways typical Jew, he made fun of Rick Sanchez quite a bit. And you could say Rick Sanchez made himself vulnerable. Sometimes he did kind of strange things on air, like allowing himself to be tasered. But he was on a talk radio show hosted by one of Jon Stewart's former employees. And the topic of Jon Stewart's lampooning of Mr. Sanchez came up. And Rick Sanchez started complaining that Jon Stewart was from a privileged background. He wouldn't know what Rick Sanchez, he wouldn't know what he had gone through growing up in a poor Cuban family in South Florida in the 1960s. The talk show host said, "Wait a minute, Jon Stewart, he's a minority himself." And Rick Sanchez said, "What? He's Jewish. Oh, yeah, yeah. Real powerless people. Yeah, right, sure." Rick Sanchez added, "Let me tell you, everybody at CNN is a lot like Jon Stewart," meaning they're Jewish, "and everybody at all the other networks is a lot like Jon Stewart. Yeah, real powerless people." Well, the next day, a real powerless Jew by the name of Jeff Zucker, who runs CNN, who was Rick Sanchez's boss, fired him immediately. Please continue with your narrative.
The discussion I mentioned earlier on Democracy Now! Was telling. All three parties to the discussion about the lack of diversity among Kagan's appointments certainly knew full well the preponderance Jews among those appointments, yet failed to mention it. Lawrence Lessig, who is not Jewish, certainly is aware of the massive overrepresentation of Jews among his colleagues at Harvard Law School. Glenn Greenwald, who is Jewish and a graduate of New York University Law School, must also have been aware. And Amy Goodman, as alternative as she is on so many issues, is one of the major Jewish media gatekeepers herself. The Jewish predominance in the media is well documented. Jewish writers from Ben Stein to Joel Stein have published articles bragging about the extent of Jewish control over the media. Not only is ownership of the major media firms to a large extent in Jewish hands, there are enough Jewish editors, reporters, producers, and other media professionals that anyone who breaks the taboo of Jewish privilege can easily be weeded out and blacklisted. The corporate media's Jewish gatekeepers have squashed all discussion of Jewish privilege. Moreover, except for a small number of internet sites, the same is true in the alternative media. Democracy Now! Is an example. As important as Democracy Now! Is in pointing out many of the failings of the media and the political establishment in many issues, Amy Goodman walks in lockstep with the rest of the media not just in keeping discussion of Jewish privilege taboo, but in actively promoting it. Her program is as stacked with Jewish guests as the rest of them. She has been very important in promoting the careers of Jewish writers, like Greenwald, who then go on to become the leading voices of the show's progressive audience. While these Jewish guests may take very harsh stances on Zionist atrocities against Palestinians, they will not touch Zionist, let alone Jewish, power within the United States, except in occasional mention of its distortion of U.S. foreign policy. Indeed, the more someone has benefited from Jewish privilege, the more likely they are to keep the taboo. Otherwise, they expose themselves as having advanced for reasons other than, or at least in addition to, qualification.
Now, you mention that Jews from Ben Stein to Joel Stein have written articles about the Jewish control of the media. And our most recent example, actually, just came a few days ago when Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz, who was not hired by Elena Kagan, but was working there under Elena Kagan. He predates her. He's older than her. He was there before she became the dean. But he gave a speech recently at which he talked about Jewish power in the media, but he was saying for Jews not to make it taboo. He really wants to kind of lord it over all of us. Let's take a listen. Mr. Engineer, can you cue that clip?
People say Jews are too powerful. We're too strong. We're too rich. We control the media. We have too much this. We have too much that. And we often apologetically deny our strength and our power. Don't do that. Don't do that. We have earned the right to influence public debate. We have earned the right to be heard. We have contributed disproportionately to the success of this country. Never, ever apologize for using our strength and our influence in the interest of peace. And if you need a biblical source for it, just remember the psalmist who said, Hashem oz li'amo yitain. God will give the Jewish people strength, oz. And then, only then, Hashem yivarech et amo b'shalom, only then will God give the Jewish people peace. Peace will come for the Jewish people and the Jewish nation only through strength. Never apologize for using your strength for peace. Thank you. I look forward to a couple of questions.
Oh, I have a question. What's up with all this Jewing? Don't apologize for using your strength for peace. Were you using your strength for peace when you Jewish Bolsheviks starved millions of goyim in the Holodomor? Somebody get this Jew a bagel. Maybe it will make him shut up. These Jews just can't restrain their delusions.
Well, you know, Norman Finkelstein wrote a book about Alan Dershowitz. The title of the book was Chutzpah. Just Chutzpah, which is Jewish for bull honk, I guess. BS. But that was Alan Dershowitz talking in Los Angeles in front of a Jewish crowd at the Stand With Us conference. It's an anti-BDS boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. It's against boycotting Israel.
Anyway, academia has its own gatekeepers. They ensure that important professions have significant Jewish overrepresentation and weed out people who are viewed as hostile to Jewish privilege. Kagan was an academic gatekeeper at Harvard. Her career advancement was always based as much, if not more, on Jewish privilege than on merit. Her appointments of Jews to at least half of the posts she filled while dean of Harvard Law School would seem to be her way of paying back those who paved the easy street of her career to date. The appointments also helped to preserve the effective Jewish veto over who gets into and who gets out of America's most prestigious law school, a veto which certainly exists in other leading universities and in other academic departments. These privileges can continue without public outrage because of the Jewish gatekeepers of the media stifle discussion of it, and anyone who tries to break the taboo does so at the risk of career loss. Shortly after President Obama nominated Kagan to the Supreme Court, the New York Times published a biographical article about her entitled A Climb Marked by Confidence and Canniness. The article contains numerous quotes from Kagan's supporters, but also mentions, albeit less prominently, her relative lack of accomplishments.
But you know, while they acknowledged her lack of accomplishments or her lack of experience, they would always emphasize, but she's so brilliant, she's so brilliant. She's so brilliant she could become a tenured professor without having published anything. She's so brilliant she could become Solicitor General without ever having argued a case in front of the Supreme Court before. She's so brilliant she could become a Supreme Court Justice without ever having been a judge before. So she gets to skip all of the prerequisites because she's so brilliant. Well, how do we really know she's so brilliant? Because she's never really written very much. What do we have to go by? Well, all that we have to go by is all of this praise from her Jewish colleagues. It's just like an empire of their own. When these Russian Jews came to Hollywood and they created a empire of their own, a movie industry, and then they created the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences in order to give awards to each other, to tell each other how brilliant they are and let the world know all about it.
These Jews are like that. What is notable is that most of the people mentioned in the article, whether they are her friends or her mentors, are Jewish. This leaves no doubt that Kagan was helped considerably along the way by fellow Jews. Her senior thesis advisor at Princeton was Sean Wilens. She worked as a summer intern for Congressman Ted Weiss. She was later given a job as assistant press secretary for Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman. Her first clerk job was for Judge Abner Mikva. She was hired as a full-time tenure-track professor by University of Chicago Law School Dean Jeff Stone at the age of 31. 4 years later, Stone gave her tenure. Shortly thereafter, Judge Mikva, who was at the time White House counsel for Bill Clinton, brought Kagan into the Clinton administration. After Clinton left office, Kagan joined the faculty of Harvard Law School and in just 2 years was appointed dean by Harvard President Lawrence Summers. Notice that all of these people who paved the way for her, Wilens, Holtzman, Weiss, Mikva, Stone, and Summers, are Jewish.
And not just Jews, but even super Jews. You take Lawrence Summers, who is probably best known for being the Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton during the last couple of years of his administration, but also as president of Harvard University, and then also as, I believe it was the head of the economic advisor team for President Obama when he first came into office. But he was also talked about as a successor to Ben Bernanke. It was pretty much between him and Kyle's mom from South Park, what's her name, Janet Yellen. But what he's not known for, but should be, is he was a assistant treasury secretary early in the Clinton administration and was sent over to Russia to be an advisor to Boris Yeltsin on privatization. He brought over with him a team, a Jewish team. Peter Orszag was very young at the time, but he came over. He later became Obama's budget director, and in between had been an advisor to the government of Iceland, led them into bankruptcy, Peter Orszag. He also brought over Jeffrey Sachs from Harvard, and these American Jewish advisors worked together with prominent Jews in the Russian government under Boris Yeltsin, and it was a very Jewish government under Boris Yeltsin, most notably Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Privatization, Anatoly Chubais. And these American Jews and Russian Jews worked together with people like George Soros, an international financier, who could funnel Jewish money, international Jewish banking money, into Russia at a time when the ruble had collapsed. And so nobody in Russia could buy anything. I mean, the ruble was worthless. You couldn't get anything unless you had hard currency. People were literally starving and freezing to death. And it was in this climate that they embarked on shock therapy privatization, the rapid privatization of assets. Well, who could buy assets? Now, the government had this voucher program where it gave each citizen a voucher with which that citizen could purchase shares in government-owned companies that were being privatized. Well, for most people, if you're starving or you're freezing and you can trade that voucher to get some food or to get some heating oil, that's what you're going to do. Jews who had access to hard currency were able to get these things. They were therefore able to get all of the vouchers or to get so many of the vouchers into their Jewish hands that they could then take over the state oil company and state gas company, and they could take over all of these state enterprises. And so you had about 16 big oligarchs, 13 of whom were Jewish, and they took over the Russian economy. And this was with the full collaboration of Lawrence Summers. He was the head of the American advisory team as assistant treasury secretary. It created such dislocation and such a collapse of the Russian economy that the Russian life expectancy for men fell by 8 years. Well, this is why Yeltsin became so unpopular, why people would say Yeltsin did in 3 years what the Bolsheviks could not do in 70 years, and that was to make communism look good. Of course, eventually, Yeltsin, who had become alcoholic, I mean, the Jews had managed to get him reelected in 1996. That's another story. If you want a Jewish Hollywood version of that story, check out the movie Spinning Boris, starring Jeff Goldblum, that very Jewish-looking Jewish actor, where they brag about having stolen the 1996 presidential elections for Boris Yeltsin. Talk about hacking elections. But by 2000, Yeltsin, there was no way he was going to get reelected. It was almost sure that the communists, who had had their elections stolen from them in 1996, they were going to take back control in the year 2000 under the leadership of Gennady Zyuganov. But this is where Vladimir Putin comes into the picture. After having gone through several prime ministers, including a couple who were Jews, Boris Yeltsin appointed Vladimir Putin as the prime minister of Russia. Putin managed to capitalize on Chechen terrorism. Some people think it was a false flag, but whatever. Managed to capitalize on terrorist incidents and get a 9/11 style rallying around the flag effect. People rallied behind him, and then he won election to the presidency after Boris Yeltsin had resigned and turned on the oligarchs who had actually put him in power, chased some out of the country, put some in jail, and made a truce with the rest, whereby they could keep their fiefdoms, but they had to stay out of politics. By doing so, he was able to resurrect the Russian economy, and he still remains wildly popular. I just wanted to get that story in there.
That's right.
Now please finish your story about Elena Kagan.
One could say that what difference does it make, as long as she was qualified? Well, she did get good grades as a student, but how far should that get you? The article pointed out that there were some objections to her getting tenure at the University of Chicago because, surprisingly for someone so prominent in academia, Ms. Kagan published very little. Her publishing track record had not improved much when she got her Harvard position. When Mikva brought her into the Clinton administration as associate White House counsel, she brought with her all of 2 years of experience practicing law. The article points out that when Obama appointed Kagan as United States Solicitor General, she had argued no cases in the United States Supreme Court and had only recently become a member of its bar. And of course, until her appointment to the Supreme Court, she had never been a judge, and her opinions on the major issues of the day were a mystery. So, Kagan's demonstrated propensity for giving plum jobs to Jews as a dean at Harvard was matched by her having benefited considerably throughout her career from employment offered to her by Jews. And just as she often did not meet the standard prerequisites for the jobs she was offered, is it so unreasonable to think that the Jewish professors she hired were not receiving at least some preferential treatment? And if that is the case, did she extend the same preferential treatment to Jewish students? Was she more likely to assign readings written by Jewish authors? Likewise, is it unreasonable to suppose that her mentors, including Weilantz, Holtzman, Weiss, Mikva, Stone, and Summers, only showed preferential treatment to her, or did they also smooth the way for other promising young Jews, just as the Jewish media gatekeepers promote the careers of other Jews? Should it be any wonder that an ethnic group with well-documented tendencies for avoiding intermarrying with others and for forming ethnic-based organizations would also promote the careers of other Jews? By making sure that there are a plethora of Jews in the most important professions, the Jewish gatekeepers of the media and of academia can keep the entire issue of Jewish privilege taboo by making sure that anyone who breaks the taboo will incur damage to their careers. And in a society where racial, ethnic, and religious discrimination otherwise is illegal, this Jewish exemption has resulted in higher and higher concentrations of Jews in positions of power in the United States and many other countries with each passing generation. Unless the taboo is broken and Jewish privilege and its implications are discussed, there will be no way to stem the tide.
Well, that was very interesting. And that is from the article, Elena Kagan's Diversity Problem and Jewish Privilege. And this was published on the Occidental Observer website, September 2nd, 2012. It was a big deal. This is actually the article that caught Dr. David Duke's attention. And he, a couple days later, contacted me and asked me to come on his radio show. And then the rest is history. But, Mr. Robot, I understand you have another article you would like to talk about.
That's right, Patrick.
And what would the title of that article be?
Want to get into Harvard? Tell them you're Jewish.
So this would be about the enormous Jewish privilege in admissions to Harvard and other elite universities. Is that right?
That's right.
And this is from December 2012. Please read the article.
It's that time of year again. The last couple of weeks before applications are due for admission to America's leading universities. High school seniors are busily filling out forms, writing essays, sending test scores, and hounding their counselors for transcripts and teachers for recommendations. Competition is fierce, and students are looking for anything that will give them an advantage. Well, here is some advice. Say you're Jewish. I have crunched the numbers, at least for Harvard. A Hispanic, not even factoring in qualifications, has an 80% higher chance of being accepted than a non-Jewish non-Hispanic white. A black has about the same chance as a Hispanic. Asians have about a 10 times higher chance. However, a Jew has a 40 times higher chance of getting in than a person of European Christian background. Here are the numbers from Harvard. Harvard enrollment for the class entering 2010. Asian 16%. Black non-Hispanic 7%. Hispanic 8%. International 10%. Mixed 3%. Unknown 12%. Jewish 24%. White non-Hispanic non-Jewish 19%.
And what were your sources?
Harvard Provost Office, Hillel. Meanwhile, this is a breakdown of the U.S. population. Asian 5%. Black 13%. Hispanic 15%. Mixed 1%. Other 1%. Jewish 2%. White non-Hispanic non-Jewish 64%. The figures I am presenting here do not account for relative qualification, only for the likelihood of a member of the various racial groups getting into Harvard. Still, it stretches the imagination that Jews are so much more qualified that they would be 40 times as likely to be Harvard material than whites. They can get away with this in large part because they can pass themselves off as white when it is convenient for them while all the while operating stealthily within their own networks. Their massive privilege is never called out, but rather misidentified as white privilege, which has the added bonus stoking the hostilities of other minorities against majority whites. This is divide and conquer at its most effective.
Okay, so this is the exact same phenomenon we see with Elena Kagan. Jewish privilege being disguised as white privilege. So how many times have we heard about Harvard being a bastion of white privilege, black students at Princeton going on strike, telling the whites they have to check their white privilege, and the Jews must just be laughing because whites have been squeezed out of these institutions. It's amazing. Now, your figures were not taking into consideration merit. And there are plenty of Jews who are going to say, oh, well, we get in because we're just smarter. We're just smarter. Now, of course, if that's the case, I mean, we're going to see how much that's the case. But if that logic is sound, if that morality is sound, that it is okay for somebody to get into the school because they're smarter, then what is the logic for affirmative action? What is the logic for reserving 15 or more percent of the seats for people of Hispanic or black ancestry? Now, you didn't factor in merit, but Ron Unz did. Ron Unz published an article called The Myth of American Meritocracy. And that's on, you can find that on ronunz.org. I think it was originally from the American Conservative magazine, which the December 2012 edition. So we were actually writing at the same time. I wasn't aware of what he was doing. If I had been, I might not have done it because to an extent I was reinventing the wheel, but even a weaker wheel, because I had not done all of the difficult work of factoring in meritocracy. Ron Unz did extensive research into things like National Merit Scholarship semi-finalists and winners of math Olympiads and all sorts of measures of merit, which I didn't have the resources to do. Now, on the other hand, my analysis was more straightforward than his. He didn't mention the white underrepresentation vis-a-vis Jews until, I don't know if it was the bottom of the article or if it was in the appendixes to the article, but it was there. And so while I found that not looking at merit, a Jewish teenager was 40 times as likely to get into Harvard as a white teenager, if you factor in all of the measures of merit, and let's face it, there are plenty of smart Jews out there, the Jewish students were only 14 times as likely to get into Harvard or other elite schools as their white counterparts with the same merit. So given the same merit, given the same grades, given the same test scores, a Jew was 14 times as likely to get into Harvard or other elite institutions. And that's amazing.
The problem, it is not limited to Harvard. The story is the same at most elite universities in the United States. For a meticulously researched and documented analysis, please refer to The Myth of American Meritocracy, How Corrupt Are Ivy League Admissions, by Ron Unz.
Well, actually, I just did.
Unz makes it clear beyond a doubt that Jewish overrepresentation at elite universities has much more to do with networking than qualifications. For an excellent summary of and commentary on Unz's long thesis, please read Kevin McDonald's review in The Occidental Observer. It is clear that not only have Jews taken over our elite universities and instituted massive preferences for their own tribe, but they are implementing systematic and severe discrimination of whites. This is a key part of their efforts to marginalize whites, as these universities are the gateway to careers of power, influence, and wealth. Now, I want to make it clear that I am not joking when I say that whites should claim to be Jewish on their college admissions. For centuries, Jews have gone crypto when it suited their interests. We need to do the same. So if you are applying or you know anyone who is applying, this is what to do. All the elite schools take applications via the online Common Application. On the Common Application's demographics page, use the optional pull-down menu about religious affiliation and select Jewish. Don't be shy. Then in the writing section, make sure you refer to your Jewish heritage in one of the two essays that you are required to submit. They have suggested topics, but you are free to think of your own. One of the suggested topics is an ethical dilemma you have faced. Talk about the dilemma you faced as a Jew having to sing Christmas carols at your school. Another topic is to describe a character in fiction or a historical figure that has had an influence on you. You can pick Anne Frank. Say you lost many relatives in the Holocaust. All of humanity is one big family, right? So we all lost relatives. Okay, so maybe you're just too honest to do any of the above. Have no fear. Almost every school's application is going to ask you why you want to apply to that school. Make sure to include among your reasons that you are attracted to the vibrant Jewish life on campus. Why not? These are the little signals that Jews give to each other that allow them to take over institutions and afford privileges to their fellow tribesmen.
Wow. I mean, certainly there are people who mislead application reviewers regarding their ancestry. I mean, Jews, like you say, Jews go crypto when it suits their purposes. I don't know. I mean, there are some whites who have masqueraded themselves as black. That's not really the same thing, is it? Because the whites who masquerade themselves as black, like that lady who wanted to be in the NAACP, Rachel Dolezal, or Sean King, he writes for some New York newspaper, but they want to make themselves be black so that they can shame whites and tell whites how horrible they are. And I do know of some people who have claim to be Jewish when they probably aren't. In fact, when I know they aren't, as a way of trying to get themselves some sort of immunity so that they can talk about the Holocaust or talk about Israel. But what you're talking about, it's more an act of defiance, more an act of rebellion, more an act of resistance, isn't it?
I want everyone to remember that this is not simply a self-serving act of deceit, but a crucial form of nonviolent resistance. If large numbers of whites pass themselves off as Jews on college applications, It will make it more difficult for Jewish admissions officers to continue with their practice of concentrating privilege on Jews and marginalizing whites. Don't worry if your name isn't Gillicuddy. In my experience, it is just those half-breeds who are most likely to wear their Jewish heritage on their sleeves. And once you're admitted, you are under no obligation to continue the masquerade. If anything, it will attract attention to Jewish privilege and white marginalization of it becomes common knowledge that whites are going crypto on their college applications in order to gain advantage in the admissions process.
That's fascinating. Is there anything else you'd like to say to the audience?
Shalom, y'all.
Well, Mr. Robot Patrick Slattery, it's been a great pleasure and honor having you on the show with us today. I hope you'll come back again sometime.
You got it, dude.
And that wraps up another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio. Be sure to tune in again next week when our guest will be some human being.
Machines to save our lives. how she's dehumanized.
Thank you.